Hey, what's up, Z-Pack? It's Dr. Z. Today, I have a really cool guest. You guys know I've been ranting and raving about vaping. I did a video on YouTube talking about Evoli, this e-cigarette vaping-related injury stuff that's been going on. It's been in the news. Well, it turns out today, I have Dr. Dixie Harris. She's a pulmonary critical care doc, also involved in sleep medicine, who works at Intermountain Healthcare in Utah. And she was the first doctor to identify the first case in Utah of vaping-related lung injury. She's since heading up their Evoli task force. And I thought we should just go right to the source to figure out what's been going on with vaping so that we can talk to our patients, we can understand how we do an intake, how we take a vaping history, because I bet a lot of people don't know how to do that. So welcome, Dixie Harris. What's up?
Not much. Glad to be out here. It's a beautiful sunny day.
Dude, the Bay Area has the weather, especially with global warming. It's like 70 degrees and I think we're going back into a drought. So it's been dry. It's really great. How's it in Utah right now?
So it's very snowy. We've had a great ski season. So nice. It's a lot of fun.
That's good. So you've been out in Utah for a while. You trained out on the East Coast in Emory and then moved out and been working with Intermountain Healthcare. Now, what was the structure of your practice that lent itself to identifying these vaping-related injuries? Because you were the first to see it in Utah and report it.
Yeah, so let me just clarify. So we saw cases of this at the U in July, but at that point, they really thought it was lipoid pneumonia.
So
the U had some cases, but it wasn't publicized, but they were thinking, oh, it was lipoid pneumonia, not recognizing it was this turned into the E-Valley outbreak.
And so when you say the U, University of Utah.
So, yeah.
Exactly.
So, but we didn't even know about it, Intermountain Healthcare. And then again, it was kind of one of these not understanding what was happening. So when we first identified him, myself, and then working with my colleagues, it was really clear it wasn't a lipoid pneumonia. It was clearly something else.
Well, now, how was it that it was diagnosed as lipoid? What were the findings that you guys saw early in July?
So what they found on bronchoscopy specimens and lung biopsies is they found lipid-laden macrophages.
Yeah.
And just basically lipoid in the lungs. However, not the typical classic findings where lipoid is diffuse all the way in the interstitium, all the way through the alveoli, whereas it's more just the alveolar macrophages absorbing the lipoid substance. And that's what they identified. However, it's clear that down the road, it wasn't the lipoid pneumonia itself. It was more the burning, basically, the chemical burn. And that's kind of what had got defined later. On autopsy series and lung biopsy series later on.
That's so interesting because lipoid pneumonia, I remember the classic teaching, and for people who don't understand this, lipoid meaning fat, mineral oil aspiration. So
right.
People who are drinking mineral oil and it gets in their lungs and they get this terrible pneumonia, this lipoid pneumonia. So this was different because it wasn't so diffuse. It was just
Correct. These
macrophages, which are cleaning up the fat. And what you were really seeing is more of a burning scenario in the lung.
And that's what we understood much later looking at autopsy series. And those are reports in the New England Journal where they reported that. And they reported the different cases of, again, open lung biopsies, bronchoscopy, and then the autopsies. They had two autopsies in their case series of 17. But that was later. That was probably, I think that came out in October.
Wow. And so how was it now? And by the way, lung biopsy, I mean, that's pretty serious. So people were wondering what the heck's going on, right?
We really don't do lung biopsies unless we absolutely don't know what's going on and we need to know.
Right. And how are they done? They're surgically done, correct?
Yeah. I mean, you can do cryogenic, which is a frozen section. Not many places in the U.S. do it, and it's has side effects, obviously bleeding complications. And then we can do transbronchial biopsies, but really the best way to get really understand the pathology of the lung is do the open lung biopsy,
right,
thoracoscopically, typically, and you get a piece about the size of a thumb.
Right.
Typically, you do multiple lung lobes. So, but we really relegate that. Like for most workups of interstitial lung disease, we are not going to open lung biopsies anymore.
Yeah, that's why I was surprised when you said lung biopsy. Mm-hmm. I thought, oh, that's interesting. And so you didn't really know what was going on. So then what was the picture? What was the radiologic picture you guys were seeing in these cases?
So, I'm going to go back to when we first found this
and
then kind of explain it. So I'm in my clinic minding my own business. I got a call from my hospitalist.
Hey, who said, help.
Hey, I'm here at my hospital and we've got this patient who's been here 5 days. They've got this diffuse infiltrate and it looks like a viral pneumonia or maybe even PJP or, you know, but the patient doesn't have HIV negative. We know the patient has been not been smoking, but has been vaping. And then they said, we have the patient on antibiotics. They're still running fevers. They are still hypoxic. They're not on the ventilator, but we have this ongoing process in the lungs. So they said, can you come over and do a bronchoscopy on the patient so we can get some further information and see, is there an infection down in there and what do we treat the patient with?
Yeah.
So I literally ran over and did the bronchoscopy emergently and sent the material off for extensive cultures, viral cultures, fungal cultures, bacterial cultures, did cellular analysis to see what kind of inflammatory cells were in there. And then we sent it off for further evaluation. So I saw that patient. It was very clear because I got the cellular analysis back pretty quickly and it was clearly inflammation, but the stains were negative. Hmm. Gram stains were negative. So I said, okay, we've got some sort of inflammation. Let's get this patient on high dose steroids. We had him covered for broad antibiotics.
When was this, by the way?
This was early August. Hmm. And then that afternoon or that evening, I had a telecritical care shift. And in our telecritical care system, we cover 24 hospitals in our system, Intermountain Healthcare, plus small other hospitals throughout the state and a couple of surrounding states.
And that's a predominantly rural state, right?
Yes,
in terms of Utah. So you need this.
Yeah, we definitely need the critical care. And then every new admission to an ICU anywhere in the system that's not covered by an intensivist. So if you're at a small hospital and you don't have an intensivist, then we will then go in and go over the case with the hospitalist or the family practice doc or whoever's at the bedside and go over the case and make sure we're going the right direction. It's very collaborative and we work together with our bedside physicians. And so what happened is the exact same scenario. So these first several cases, we saw several days of nausea, vomiting, fevers, horrible achiness, feeling like they had the flu, but this is August.
So systemic inflammatory symptoms. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I mean, terrible abdominal pain. Most of them ended up getting abdominal CT scans.
Wow.
Because the pain was so bad. And many times the abdominal pain and the abdominal symptoms predated the pulmonary symptoms. And these were all young patients. And we were talking, the first several patients we saw were under age 30.
Wow.
And no health problems. No medical problems.
So this weird syndrome of abdominal pain, flu-like symptoms, then progressive pulmonary symptoms.
Right. And then the x-ray pattern, the ones we've seen have been very classic. I mean, there are several reported different patterns of this. Again, this is a syndrome, so we just kind of put it together. But the one that's typical is the one we have pictures of and we can show. So a second patient, second hospital. Same day, identical symptoms. Mm. So we actually, because we still didn't know what it was, we moved that patient to one of our big hospitals that had a person that can do an emergent bronchoscopy. Mm. So we did a bronchoscopy on that patient. And then again, put the patient on steroids because they'd already been on antibiotics and the stains were all negative. And then two days later, so not the next day, but the day after, I was doing another telecritical care shift and I ran into two more cases, identical symptoms, two other hospitals. So four hospitals, four identical situations, scenarios.
Wow.
And kids in their 20s who didn't have any medical problems.
So this is already triggering probably your spider sense. Like this is not normal. It's not something you see. These are findings that you would see in like, you know, a strange infectious thing or a strange environmental exposure, or there's a whole differential diagnosis.
Exactly. That's what we're thinking. And then these kids were all, you know, we were getting the vaping history. So where's like what you're vaping, your vape. And then most these, especially these early, actually, especially most of our cases, they're vaping pretty much continuously e-nicotine. Like all the time.
So always, so in other words, background radiation of just constant e-nicotine use.
Yeah, almost all our cases did e-nicotine. And then many of them admitted to, and then we would get sometimes, we didn't do tox screens on everybody because if they told me they were vaping THC, okay, I know they're vaping, I don't have to get a tox screen. So I'd say a large percentage were also vaping THC.
Got it.
And so THC oil, be very real, it's, you know, it's an oil base. And, so that's kind of where it kind of led down the path.
And were these pre-made vape pens that they sell at dispensaries, or were they sort of, they're buying the juice separate and they're vaping it out of a different device, or is it the pen? What were you
seeing? So most of the patients were doing, you know, at the time, most of it was Juul, because Juul owned the market as far as e-nicotine.
Right.
As far as the THC, it was all over the board. It's all open container. So they add, you know, whether they bought it pre-added from cartridge from a friend or black market or behind the garage, or, you know, it was a very interesting, because we in Utah, we don't have medical marijuana. So we have no dispensaries.
Got it.
And so patients were having to get their THC elsewhere.
Like Vegas.
Vegas, yeah, or you know, somewhere actually else. Vegas, well, and yeah, Colorado, or and
black market.
Yeah, and California.
And what, just this is a side thing, but I think it's kind of interesting. So the LDS Church in Utah, what is their sort of stance in general on vaping?
So, you know, there is an acknowledgement, and I'm not a representative of the church,
of course,
so I'm not going to speak for them, but there is a medical indication for THC. So let's take that
separate
off
thing.
The table.
Yeah.
As far as nicotine and smoking, they're anti-nicotine and smoking. As far as vaping, THC, recreational, I don't know. My guess is no, but I can't tell you. What do you?
So it's not necessarily a condoned thing by the predominant religious group there. So that's interesting. So this is sort of a side thing, a black market thing, not something that you come out and just go, hey, I'm doing this.
Well, and that's the other thing is through all this identification, and again, you know, when I first found this and I was asking my colleagues, I say, have you seen the case? You look at this. Because again, remember when you do sign off, right? You talk to your colleagues, and if you have an interesting case, hey, look at this. What do you think about this? So one of my colleagues actually said, hey, I got a notification from Wisconsin. They saw a small series of cases there, and they had alerted there through the Department of Health. And so after we identified the first several cases, I called our Department of Health. And that's how the whole evaluation and the alerting happened.
That's fascinating, because I remember reading that Wisconsin had the first sort of publicly reported cases of the association. And I remember reading about it in the news. And so then you put two and two together with your colleagues and said, hey, wait a minute.
We need to get this looked at.
That's fascinating. And again, this speaks to a couple things in my mind. One is the telehealth component, which allows you to see a lot of geographically disparate patients and make connections. Because if there were different docs in all those places, would the connections have been
made? You would not have made it.
It's interesting. So
by focal, like unifying it to telecritical care, and then all our nurses have been watching for it. All our telecritical care nurses. Ever since we started looking for it, we let all our nurses know, every time you see a patient, especially a young patient who has these x-ray findings, try to get a history of vaping.
Ah, wow. And I want to, do not let me forget to come back to the nursing component of this in terms of triage and in terms of our call to action towards the end, which is, this is how you get a history of it. This is how you look for it. This is the questions you ask. This is how you would report it. And then, so what you were seeing then, what was the course of the disease that you were seeing? Was it very severe?
So very early on, and in fact, even now, we're at over 122, but we just analyzed the data on 114, and we're about a third land in the ICU. We initially had a few require mechanical ventilation. However, I don't think any in the last 30 have needed mechanical ventilation. So our course has decreased as far as severity, and for multiple reasons. Number one, we figured out very quickly, rule out typical infections. You know, again, this occurred pre-flu season. So we didn't have to worry about the flu so much, even though we did run the RFAs for the viral panels for flu and all the other types of viruses. We were less worried about the flu. And then most of the times we would cover for atypical bacterial infections empirically. And then once we got our testing back negative, then we would stop that. But meanwhile, many times within the first 24, 48 hours, after we figured out how to treat this, we get them on steroids pretty quick.
Got it. So high dose steroids, empiric antibiotics covering atypicals, the kind of pneumonias you would see.
Right.
Ruling out viral pneumonias, but not so worried about flu early because it was August or something.
Right.
But of course, now it's a little more complicated. You have to rule all those other things out because they can look very similar. Getting a good history and then seeing how it unfolded. Were you seeing a lot of secondary infections, secondary pneumonia?
So we have seen some,
yeah.
And that's very concerning. We've seen, and then that's actually been reported nationally that subsequent people will have pneumonias or other sequelae. We've seen barotrauma, pneumothoraces, pneumomediastinums.
Is this from ventilation or is this from just the disease process?
The disease and the vaping.
Ooh. Oh, wow. So the vaping itself is causing some structural...
So I can't prove that,
yeah.
But there's a lot of correlation there that... and I'm not sure, but I have a feeling it's the vaping e-nicotine that's also contributing. So I've had several patients that have had spontaneous pneumothoraces.
Wow.
And they continue to vape while they're in the hospital, and until we got them to stop vaping, then we were able to get the chest tubes out.
Holy smokes.
So
just real quick, would you ever let your kids vape if they asked you?
I would tell them not to.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the thing is the kids can hide it. So almost always the parents don't know.
Yeah.
And the youngest I've seen is 14.
14. And this is the thing about vaping. And again, I say this from personal experience. I've tried vape pens to try them out.
Mm-hmm.
It's enjoyable. It doesn't smell. If it has nicotine, you get nicotine. If it has something else, you get something else. It's discreet. You can do it in places where people would never know. This is a technology that has not existed. It used to be if you're going to smoke cigarettes, you're going to stink. You're going to be stigmatized. There's going to be a lot of stuff going on. Now it's like you can do all of this. It tastes like candy, the way the Juul flavor juices are. And people who would never have smoked before are now trying and starting. And, you know, there's a whole harm reduction thing. Well, if you're smoking already, then vaping's the only thing that gets you to quit. Well, okay, that's fine. How about this? How about we try never to start? And so I did a rant on this and got a lot of pushback from the vaping community. There's a community of vapers.
Yeah, you will get
it. I'm sure you're getting it too. And the thing is, okay, that's fine. That's great.
Yes.
Kids, and I say this, kids are debilitated and potentially dying on ventilators, having complications from something that we just don't even understand well enough to understand. So let's just put that clearly out there so people understand why we get so preachy about it. Because otherwise, look, hey, I love to have fun too. I don't like to die. I don't like young people to be hurt. So that's really the bottom line. So I just had to put that out there before we go deeper in the rabbit hole of what could be the components of this that are actually causing it. Yeah. So have you had any, since you're kind of public about this, any sort of pushback from...
You know, I have not looked at my reviews. I'm sure I'm getting some. I look
don't
at
Don't go
it,
to Yelp.
Yeah. I will just say this, you know, I am taking care of patients weekly.
Yeah.
I see them weekly in clinic. I see them weekly in the hospital who have suffered and have injured lungs from this.
Mm.
So a few questions are, do they have long-term injury? We don't know.
Right.
And that's one of the things we're studying. And I still have some patients who are still on oxygen. The other thing I will say about this whole E-Valley. So we've got E-Valley.
Right.
And then we have other probable lung injuries and other injuries from vaping. Okay, so I kind of look at this whole E-Valley event as to kind of shining the light of what was happening on a medical standpoint to the lungs and to the body with vaping.
Mm.
So all of a sudden the medical community is now very focused on this, right?
Yeah.
And so we turned on the light, so we see the big monster of E-Valley.
Yeah.
But we also see the roach, the cockroach there of just smoking e-nicotine. Oh, and there's maybe a little rat over there of vaping essential oils. You know, so we're really learning, different things that you vape get deep in the lungs can cause different types of damage.
Hey, you know, and why does this surprise us so much? You know, it's like this makes sense. You're inhaling foreign material deep into lung. These are tiny particles. They're the products of combustion or heating. And we just don't know enough about it. I mean, how long did it take us before to even recognize that cigarettes caused lung cancer, emphysema,
right.
and the other things it did. It took us for quite a while. And
decades.
Decades. And it didn't help that there was a lot of lobbying from tobacco and that sort of thing.
Right.
And that doctors were smoking at the nurse's station. And, you know, and so now it's like, I think we have a better public health apparatus. And it's interesting because now you're using technology like this telehealth network that you have. You have Intermountain, which is actually, this is not necessarily a pure academic institution. This is a multi-specialty health system that now is actually on the ground recognizing and transmitting this knowledge so that we can improve outcomes. So I think that's very important to point out. I mean, you're not an academic physician, right?
No, not me. I take care of patients,
yeah.
and I'm trying to mitigate my patient's suffering. And that's been my goal all along. As soon as we recognize it, we want to get it out everywhere, let people know. And I will also say that most of my patients, and we don't understand as far as E-Valley, they'll tell me they are vaping the THC. Mm. In addition, most of them are also doing e-nicotine. But we do know it's the THC, the tainted THC, was the culprit in E-Valley. Okay, so we can talk about that. But
yes.
what these kids are telling me, and I'm saying kids, 20s, 30s, they're
in other words, kids. Yeah.
They're telling me that, yeah, I'm doing it with my friends. I got really sick, but nobody else got sick. So there's some sort of individual susceptibility.
Yeah.
Because many times, you know, especially in Utah, they're getting it surreptitiously, illegally, or they call it black market, you know, however you want to define it. But they're not getting it from legitimate sources.
Yeah. So the question again is, it's like anything in the supplement industrial complex. You know, we talk about the healthcare industrial complex and pharma and all that. The supplement industrial complex is fully unregulated. You never know what's even in your vitamins. And then you have people, you know, with essential oils that they're vaping and things like that. And because it's natural, or because, you know, like THC comes from a natural cannabis plant, people think it's okay. And it's absolutely, that's right. crazy talk. So what was it? Was it the vitamin E acetate that I keep reading about? They think we're seeing on the bronchial alveolar lavages is the culprit. Do we know what it is? What is going on?
So, you know, first off, we don't have an animal model yet. You know, so, you know, going back to scientifically proving something causes something, right?
Right.
You have to be able to repeat it in a scientific setting. We haven't done that.
Right. We have correlation. That's
we
it.
We have correlation, yeah. but it's really
pretty strong
because not only are we finding vitamin E acetate in the THC oil. Now, mind you, the THC oil should be 70 to 90% pure THC.
Right.
Okay. In Utah, we found when we analyzed it, it was 15 to 30% pure.
Mm.
So it's been diluted.
Yeah. So what else is there?
Yeah. And again, like one of my patients was telling me, yeah, the black market THC cartridges cost $20. But when I go get it from a medical dispensary in California, it's $100 plus $20 tax. So the point of it is there's this level of
dilution,
which is there's financial incentives for that.
Of course.
So you have this diluted THC cartridge. So we know that. And vitamin E is not supposed to be in there at all. So they're diluting. But vitamin E viscosity is very similar to THC oil.
Ah.
It passes what they call the bubble test.
Oh, so to explain that.
So the bubble test is when you turn the THC oil in the cartridge upside down, the bubble will kind of
slowly
rise
up. Yeah.
So indicating the viscosity, same color. So vitamin E acetate, you turn it upside down. So these kids and these people who are using it, they think they're actually getting legitimate THC oil.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, and I will say, you know, these kids are doing it innocently. People really didn't realize how much potential harm they could be doing to their lungs because it's been considered extremely safe.
Yeah. Yeah. And it has.
You know, so.
I think the bigger companies, for the most part, we haven't seen a lot of stuff happening. And so I think the vape guys will say, well, this is just bad product, bad use pattern, whatever it is. And you can't judge the whole vaping industry by it. But the truth is we still just don't have enough data on any of this long term.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's what, and that's the other thing is, okay, so if you smoke cigarettes, you smoke a pack a day. It's 30 to 40 years before we see the increased risk of lung cancer, before we see the COPD. You know, when does the COPD start? 20, 30 years later is when we start really seeing it.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean it's not damaging. It's just little damage all along.
Yeah.
And then the problem is, especially with nicotine, the brain is so addicted that you can't stop.
Yeah. It not only can't you stop, but what you see is the psychology of denial. So people get very defensive about it because they are dependent on this. You see it also in people who suffer from cannabis hyperemesis syndromes and things mm-hmm. like that. If you tell them it's actually the cannabis that you're smoking for your nausea that's causing your nausea, and right. you're taking these, you're doing this classical behavior like taking these hot showers, and they go, "No way, bro!" And they walk out. They're angry, vomiting, and angry, and mm-hmm. it's because you're challenging a core belief. You know, it's like that movie Inside Out. You have they're all these little things in your brain that are pulling the strings, little emotions and these core memories and core beliefs, and you're challenging a core belief, and they're going to have all this confirmation bias. They're going to pull studies that support what they think and reject any information that directly challenges it. That's been one of the challenges with this. So I think the first step, like you said, is let's do the science. Like, what's an animal model? You know, we got to find an armadillo or something that loves to vape and study it and see what it's doing and make sure that we can actually show as much causality as is reasonable.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Even with cigarettes, it was such a strong correlation, you know, 10,000x, you know, whatever it was,
right.
risk of lung cancer, that it just became clear and there was a mechanism and there was, you know, it was plausible. So whether it's vitamin E acetate as an adulterant in the setting of THC oil combined with background nicotine smoking that maybe puts you at risk, who knows how it's interacting with air pollution and other insults to lung. We just don't know.
We don't know.
Which
yeah.
may be why some get sick and some don't.
Some don't. I mean, for example, and you know this, only about 20% of people who smoke really get COPD. You know,
yeah.
it's, you know, there's, and then women who smoke tend to have more airway reactivity with their COPD and emphysema. You know, so it's variable of, you know, what how your body handles it. You and I have both seen patients in their 80s and 90s who've smoked all their lives, have no heart disease, have no lung disease, they're perfectly fine. That's the unusual case, obviously.
Yeah.
But not everybody gets sick with this. But why take a chance? Why put something in your lungs like this?
That's what I said in my video. And I got, you should see the comments on this thing. I don't care. I don't read them. I read like three of them and I'm like, oh, I get it. They're like, but, listen, old man, why are you telling me what to do with my body? This helped me quit smoking. This is harm reduction. It's the adulterated stuff. And it's like, but why? Let's just go back to the but why. You yeah. don't need to do it. It's not necessary for survival. And it puts you at risk. Now, people have to do the risk-benefit calculation.
Right.
And I think it's our job to be able to understand what the risk and benefit calculation is. Now, we're really good at the risk. We often don't talk about the benefit for people that they seem to derive. And mm-hmm. I think that's, like, cigarettes are an interesting one. Like, it's so easy as a pulmonologist, I imagine, to be like, this is the worst thing in the world. Why would you ever do this? And then you talk to the smoker and you realize this is their only social connection. They sit smoking with their friends. There's an oral, hand-oral sort of thing. There's so much that goes into the addictive dependency to nicotine. It's not just the nicotine.
Yeah, I mean, nicotine of a drug, it's very unique because when you're stressed and you smoke, it calms you down.
Yeah.
And then when you're feeling really sad, depressed, you smoke, it makes you feel better. It's very interesting. It has a binary effect.
You know, I don't know about you, Dixie, but I'm really craving a cigarette right now. And I'm thinking menthol. I don't know. I had a quick question about that. So are menthol cigarettes worse than regular tobacco, to your knowledge? I just don't know the answer to this.
I don't know the answer.
Yeah.
No.
Because it's another adulterant, right? And it's this
I mean, it's been around for years. So yeah. But I don't know that there's been any studies to say show safety. I know that there's been a big push in the e-cigarette to get rid of the flavoring. Okay.
Yeah.
But not completely.
Right.
Because there's an exception, right? So, and that's why, and I get this from, because I talk to the 20-year-olds and they tell me,
yeah.
oh yeah, my friends, they're now doing the, what they call puff bars, because it's disposable flavored e-nicotine.
Mm.
So there's apparently, they can sell that, the disposable ones, instead of the reusable ones.
I see.
So the flavoring is still somewhere in there. And that's
the loophole for, they'll always find
it. It's a loophole. And, you know, and I think it's important for people to realize none of these flavorings have been tested for safety. It's designed to go into your stomach and be absorbed and metabolized, right? You know, you have acids in your stomach to metabolize it, right? We don't have that in the lung.
In fact, you are avoiding with pulmonary, and you have to remind me of the anatomy here, are we avoiding first pass metabolism when things go through lung? Because they're getting absorbed, they're going to back
I mean,
you're
mainstreaming nicotine. When you vape nicotine, I mean, I remember when we would use, in the old days, we used to do codes, we'd put what? Epinephrine right in the ET tube?
Yeah.
It goes right into the bloodstream.
Yeah.
And it's you know, the airways are surrounded by blood vessels. The alveoli are surrounded by blood vessels and just absorb so quickly.
Instantly. Well, you know, and so it's interesting because when you think about how quickly this stuff goes to your brain, I'll mm-hmm. give an example. So people who smoke DMT, which is one of the most powerful psychedelics, there's a crystalline form of it. Joe Rogan talks about this on his show. Others have talked about this. The description, and actually my producer, Tom Heineber, has done this and described this. You inhale from the bong, the substance, mm-hmm. and on the exhale, so the out-breath, you are launched out of your body into a psychedelic universe of no ego and all this. That means that that's like...
It's gone in immediately.
And it's in your brain. It's mm-hmm. crossed the blood-brain barrier in your brain. There's no first pass. There's nothing. It's just going straight. So that's what we're doing with these compounds. Mm-hmm. And we need to understand what we're doing so kids understand the risks and benefits of it. I think right now nobody knows, and they think it's, they just assume it's safe because it's out there. And that's why the work you're doing is so important. Now, but here's a question. So how do you do this workup? How would you advise people, whether they're doing telecritical care, telehealth, primary care, nursing triage, how do you work up a case like this when they come in?
So, you know, this is very important because let me tell you the experience. Many times, the first time we ask, we don't get the history. Mm. Maybe they'll admit to smoking or vaping e-nicotine. Maybe. Sometimes it takes several providers to even get the patient to admit to doing THC. Mm. You know, so what I say is they don't. And I think it's people are denying. You know, don't want to admit this is actually causing my lung issues, right?
And
so they don't want to always answer yes to doing it.
And I'll say that this data is supported by a Kaiser study that looked at women who were asked about cannabis use during pregnancy and then were subsequently tested. And it turns out, I think roughly half of them were not being honest about cannabis use. So people are very much close to the chest on this stuff.
On this.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of it is they're coming for help, obviously. You know, yeah. if you're going to see them, they're coming because they're having medical problems. So I'm very empathetic from that standpoint. You know, yeah. We want to help you, but we have to continue to ask the questions. So the question I ask now, this is the latest, because part of it is the vaping. Now we have the heat not burn system, the IQOS system.
Yeah.
And just got released in the fall, first store in Atlanta. So again, taking the tobacco leaf and heating not burning, essentially turning it vaporous form. So again, as somebody wouldn't call it vaping.
Right. It's an old school vaporizer. Yeah, yeah. Where it heats it. And I might have had one of those in college.
So instead of trying to, now do you vape? Do you use a water pipe? Do you use a hookah? Do you do this? Do you do a cinder? You know, you can either go ask all these things or say, do you breathe anything into your lungs other than air?
Ooh, I like
and
that.
And I just simplify it. The other thing that I found that's been very helpful is, you know, reviewing our cases and reviewing when they first present. So many of our cases present to Instacare first, then get sent home.
You probably have
a virus. You can go home, urgent care, Instacare, or to their primary care. And then they'll go back in. And and most of these E-Valley cases were stomach, you know, GI symptoms, right? So they would say, well, you probably have a stomach bug. You know, you're fine. But if you get worse, come back in. You know, that's always the answer. Or they're always a recommendation, but many times, you know, so we have our intake. And our intake in our system, we've codified, do you smoke? But we have not put into our EMR the questions of vaping. And so our nurses are asking, and people are a lot more aware to ask. Mm. So first off, we've got to ask the question. Mm. We may not always get the correct answer the first time we ask. So I say, ask.
Yeah.
We need to put it into our EMRs. So it's like a checklist, right? You don't have to remember to ask the question. It's there. You go through it. And our intake nurses, especially in EDs, are critical. The first person that sees the patient, right?
Yeah.
They're, in fact, many times that's where we get our data, like somebody's coming in, they're coughing, they've had these GI symptoms, and maybe they're starting to be a little short of breath. And mind you, these are young people, so they've got good lungs.
Yeah.
But the nurse will ask the questions, and many times it's, oh, the SAT's 91. Mm. 91% SAT on a 23-year-old. That is not normal.
That's very abnormal. And that's one of the criteria, right? Like less than 95% stat, you and the history of vaping, you probably want to... Do you admit them? What do you do at that point?
Well, you know, we actually have been very aggressive in our system, and we've treated several as outpatients. I will say if you treat them as an outpatient, very close follow-up.
Yeah.
And the patients are educated as such.
Yeah.
And it really is the milder cases. Obviously, if they're severely hypoxic, they have to come in the hospital. I've had one patient that I co-managed with my internist. We were able to keep the patient at home, but she had to come see us daily.
Wow.
We had to put her on oxygen. Mm-hmm. We, you know, did just what we talked about. Cover with antibiotics until we get our testing negative.
Oral steroids? Or?
And then we put on oral steroids.
Got it. Mm-hmm. And doing that at home. Yeah.
And she did it at home, but it was only because we were able to follow her, and we made sure there was somebody at home with the patient.
I gotcha. And so otherwise, let's say they're not doing so great. The kind of algorithm of workup at that point is you bring them in and you're imaging... And you start, I imagine, with just a plain film chest x-ray.
Chest x-ray. And then we do see normal chest x-ray. And then you get the CAT scan. Oh. And it can be markedly abnormal. Almost always, if they're severe enough,
yeah.
The chest x-ray is abnormal.
And does pulmonary embolism masquerade as this sort of constellation ever?
No, I will tell you, we've had DVTs, PEs. We've had an... left atrial thrombus. Mm. There is something going on with coagulation, but we're not sure whether it's just an association or if there is something going on. But we've seen, for example, we've seen more barotrauma, pneumothoraces, pneumomediastinums, and then we've seen more DVTs, PEs in this cohort. So we're looking at that, but PEs are not going to cause this diffuse ground glass infiltrate.
Right, exactly. You know? And that's what you're seeing. And actually, we'll throw up, you sent a chest x-ray, which we'll throw up right now, and a CT scan as well. And what you're seeing is this ground glass opacities on the CT scan bilaterally. And that's a key thing, right? Bilateral, typically.
Yeah. I mean, I have seen mostly unilateral, but usually there's a little... It's usually diffuse, because if you think about it, you vape, you're going to vape throughout
everywhere.
The lung. You know,
yeah.
You can't... there is some, you know, differential as far as some people maybe aerate a little better one side of the lung versus the other, but generally it's a bilateral.
Mm-hmm.
But... if somebody gives me a vaping history and has been vaping this THC, and they got the THC from the black market, and they have this dense ground glass, but it's mostly just on one lung, I'm still going to believe
E-Valley. Still going to believe E-Valley, yeah.
But I'm going to cover for atypical infections.
That's
anyway.
Right. Do you bronch all these guys?
No.
No.
So we took the stance of we are clinicians, we take care of patients, and we try to do the best care and also be judicious with expenses.
Yeah.
And so we're not going to...
And complications.
And complications. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So our stance was, once we were clear, we understood how this happened and what was going on. And again, we have a group of 30 telecritical care docs, and we're all talking to each other, and we're all working at different hospitals. So we're, you know, we had this very rapid dissemination of education.
That's great.
So we really understood how to manage these patients. We disseminated care process guidelines. In fact, I think we sent you some.
Yep.
And you know, we really disseminated knowledge base. So once we realized and we're okay, we don't need to bronch every one of these cases. We did the first several.
Sure.
And then actually several of our cases are actually in part of the New England Journal article that show the vitamin E acetate in the BAL fluid. And we also did, now of course, in our day when we trained, what did you test for lipoid? It was Sudan black stain.
Oh, interesting.
And now we're doing oil red O.
So different.
Yeah, it's a different stain.
Yeah.
But it's still giving us the same information.
The same info.
So when people talk about oil red O stain, that's what they're talking
that's
about.
They're looking
for the red stained macrophages, and you know that there's oil in the macrophages.
And in all your cases, how many will have that be positive if you did a BAL on them, say,
I think all our oil red O's, there may have been one that wasn't positive.
Got it.
But again, we didn't, you know, we have over 120 cases.
Yeah. And you're not BALing all of them.
We probably BAL'd 20, 30.
Got it. And you're certainly not lung biopsying these.
No.
Yeah, no way. And in terms of the ones that need mechanical ventilation, is it an ARDS type picture where you're prone ventilating and you're doing all of this? Are you doing ECMO or is it, because I heard even that somebody got a lung or needed a lung transplant.
No, we have a real aggressive lung protective strategy ventilation computerized protocol for lung ventilation. So, and we're part of the PEDALS program, which is the ARDS network throughout the country. So we have, in our system, we've standardized mechanical ventilation. So we're doing lung protective strategy. So low tidal volume, you know, that kind of thing. And then, so what we found is we haven't had as many people on mechanical ventilation. We haven't lost one of these patients.
So you have no fatalities.
We have fatalities in our cohort from other medical problems.
Got it.
Okay. But not from their EVALI per se.
I see.
In our group. But again, we're doing lung protective.
I won't say.
We may have put some, we may have prone somebody.
Okay.
We didn't do any ECMO.
No ECMO in Utah. Got it.
Well, we have it in at the U. We just started our ECMO program, but none of ours needed to be transferred for ECMO.
Got it. And so nationally, there's been roughly 40 deaths, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And one lung transplant, it sounds
As far as I know. And I have a friend of mine from pulmonologist from Florida, and she says she's got a patient that's probably going to get a lung transplant.
Yeah.
So it's...
What's the average life expectancy, you think, after lung transplant?
Yeah, it's 60-70% 5-year survival. I think it's, I don't know that that's moved very much. I mean, we've done a lot better on immunosuppression, you know, rejection meds, and getting on top of the different complications, but that's not my area of expertise. You can look it up on UpToDate and or somewhere and get better data than I just
gave you. It's more the feeling that If you need a lung transplant, that's not a magical answer, and it means that this is a serious thing, and we ought to really take it seriously.
Yeah, I mean, again, the incidence is very low.
Yeah.
Okay, so a lot of people are vaping, very, very small percent. But then the question is, what are we going to see in 20, 30 years?
That's my
We've got
concern.
A whole group of kids vaping now.
Right. Are we going to see COPD? Are we going to see weird cancers? Are we going to see strange pulmonary hypertension? We don't know what we're going to see.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're in your 20s, you can do almost anything.
And I might have. Yeah. I might have extended that in my 30s. But yeah, I would say that, and again, I think if you're going to influence young people too, we have to understand where they're coming from, like what's motivating them. And honestly, I mean, I was there. I understand it. This is very attractive as a strategy, vaping, that is, compared to what existed before it. But what we're not teaching is what are the risks. And it was pretty clear with cigarettes, you kind of got taught the risks. And you did it because you didn't care, or you made the assumption that you were going to quit at some point, or whatever it is. Like,
right.
I think very few people start smoking young and they're like, I'm going to smoke the rest of my life. I think it's very unusual. So it's interesting, the psychology around it. And so here's a question. We're talking about risk, and we're talking about, you know, the wide prevalence of vaping and the small incidence of the actual damage. But we don't know what'll happen down the line. What are your thoughts on this coronavirus thing?
You have the lung doctor in, so he's going to have to ask.
Got to ask about that, because we're working on a parody for it, My Corona by the Knack. But that's a whole nother discussion. But have you been involved at all in any preparation for what may be the inevitable appearance of it in your state, or is it not yet something that?
As far as I know, as of last night, it hadn't hit the state.
Yeah.
You know, but so in our system, we have a really well vetted infectious disease dissemination of information. So, for example, we have what we call Germ Watch. In fact, I was just looking at it. So, our influenza A is going up, influenza B, RSV is going up, not as high as last year. You know, so we get these graphs, so we get this knowledge of what's going up, what viruses are out there, metapneumovirus, other viruses. So we're tracking this, and this is sent to the clinicians.
Okay? Across the Intermountain system.
Across the system.
Using your EHR data, probably.
Yes.
Yeah, Epic.
And we have Cerner.
Oh, Cerner, okay.
So, and this is really run through infectious diseases. And then they've also, I mean, we've gotten several alerts, the clinicians, as to what to do, how to isolate, steps to be done. So if I have a patient that has at risk, in fact, it's part of our now our intake system.
Oh, yeah, you're asking questions.
Every person that comes in, have you been to mainland China?
Reminds me of Ebola, yeah.
You know, so it's important to know. We've got our state people travel all the time. And so it's very important to know, is anybody at risk? And then we have protocols to set in isolation. So I am not worried about how we do it because we can ask the questions, we'll isolate quickly, we'll send the testing off. We have a very well vetted system. It's interesting because the E-Valley was an infection.
Right.
So we had all our protocols in place how to handle infection. In fact, infectious diseases was early on involved in our E-Valley outbreak. But then they backed off because it's not an infection.
Thinking it's a mystery. And that's appropriate, right?
Yeah.
Because is this some weird atypical new infection? Is it a fungus? Is it something that we're not testing for? Do you guys get cocci out where you are? Is it endemic?
Very little.
Yeah.
And so and that was the other thing is some of the places, you know, in the Midwest, Ohio, they had, you know, histo, right?
Yeah.
So they worry about that. And then patients, if you're down in Arizona, you have to worry about valley fever.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So it really depended on kind of the area of the country. So the areas of the country that they had other endemic funguses that could mimic this, those really don't create quite these x-ray pictures, but you have to be careful. They were more aggressively testing for those other entities.
It makes perfect sense.
I mean, mind you, when I did a bronchoscopy, obviously I sent it off for fungal cultures, but
you have to, yeah.
None of ours were positive.
Yeah, wow. So what do you think is the next step in this E-Valley syndrome understanding? What are you working on next?
So again, we're a big clinical system. We are working with the University of Utah. We've combined efforts. So we're looking at long-term, what's the effects of these patients that have been impacted? What are the damage to their lungs? We're probably not going to be doing, these are young people, so we're probably not going to be doing surveillance CT scans. What, you know, we have to be careful exposing people to radiation. We can do lung testing. That's safe.
Yeah.
And we can do questionnaires. We're also going to be working with patients. We're going to get a group of our patients together and see what we can learn from them going forward. You know, get from the patients themselves. What happened? Why'd you do this? What's happening? What's out there? Talk to us about what's going on in the community.
Are you finding that any of them are really failing to quit vaping? Even after all this?
So we've had a couple resume vaping, land back in the hospital.
Oh my God, really?
And then stop vaping again.
Oh, so it triggered right away. Mm-hmm. And that was just e-nicotine probably they were vaping, or they were going back to THC? We don't know.
Don't know.
Oh my gosh. And it speaks to how powerful.
And again, those were early on cases.
Right.
And some of the cases we found in retrospect. Okay? So we're cases in, so we started looking in August. But then maybe we had a patient from July, and then we said, wait, were you vaping? Have you been vaping? Oh, that's why you came back in the hospital.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And again, this was a whole learning curve. So long-term, what are the outcomes?
Right.
We are trying to, we as in the medical community, scientific community, would like to develop an animal model. And I know that somebody's working on that, but we're not working on that.
Sure.
And then the other thing is how to, one other project we're thinking about trying to do is some sort of AI with radiographic identification of this.
Oh, that'd be interesting. Yeah.
So again, this is very
pattern
preliminary, but again, we're trying to learn. And then we've actually published data, and we're going to be publishing more data, educating people, not only kind of what we found, what we've done, our protocols. We've been disseminating our protocols widely. So other people, if they, you know, they're up in Idaho, they've never seen a case. Oh, what did Intermountain Docs do? Because, you know, we have one of the largest cohorts. How'd they do? And we're available by phone. I've been called from multiple states, out of the country. So
it's really cool. What's really cool about that is you're a clinician. So you're on the front lines.
I take care of patients.
Like you don't have to be a pointy-headed academic cloistered in some tower to actually do really good science in the world. And it's epidemiology, it's clinical care, and it's just being a good human being and a good doctor. So I was really stoked when I heard from you and was really thrilled to have you on the show. Now, I want you to throw me a bone here because one of your other, as we kind of wrap up, one of your other passions is complicated pulmonary sleep stuff. Can you just take me through real quick? Like, what is that? Like, what are you working? Like, how does that?
So I'm boarded and I've trained in critical care medicine, pulmonary medicine, and then sleep medicine.
Yeah.
So because there's not enough pulmonologists to see all the pulmonary cases, you know, we're in short supply. So we really don't see a lot of the simple. I'm not going to see the simple asthma case in my clinic.
Right.
But so I have a patient maybe has severe COPD or maybe has severe hypoxia, pulmonary hypertension. But then they also have sleep apnea. And sometimes I'll see the patients with central sleep apnea, a combination. So those are the cases that I tend to see more than just a garden variety sleep apnea. They have no other medical problems.
Got it. Tell me about central sleep apnea. What are some of the causes of that?
So central sleep apnea is very interesting, yeah. And there can be multiple causes. You know, you get the chain strokes,
yep.
Right, with heart failure.
Heart failure.
And then you can have it from a number of neurologic diseases. Mm. I have a patient who's been on a ventilator at night because he does not breathe after having a brainstem stroke.
Oh, wow.
You know, so it, you know, there's a lot of drivers for respiration. When you're awake, you have a lot more drivers, but then you go to your autonomic system and there's a lot of things that can break down.
Yeah.
Closed head injuries, TBIs, you know.
Do you see vets as well, or you're mm-hmm. not? Yeah, mm-hmm. Got it.
And so you can have idiopathic hypersomnia or hypersomnia post TBI. It can affect your respiration centers.
Mm.
Almost always the chemical imbalance triggers it, breathing, right?
Right, right.
You know,
right.
So your CO2 rises enough, you get enough acidotic, so you'll breathe.
Yeah.
You know, because you'll have other drivers for breathing.
Right,
but so
right.
Central sleep apnea is very fascinating. We still don't really understand chain strokes.
Yeah. Yeah, we never did back in the day.
No, we don't.
We just learned to recognize it. Do you see any secondary pulmonary hypertension from these disorders?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how do you manage that? You treat the underlying disorder.
So you decide, okay, first off, treat the underlying disorder. And then I have some patients that I will treat the pulmonary hypertension patients with pulmonary hypertension meds.
Right. Flolan or something?
Well, not usually.
Not that.
That goes to the primary pulmonary hypertension people.
Right, right.
But I'll do like Traclear, Sildenafil, meds.
Got it.
But
Viagra, we call it, but it's not.
Yeah. It's different dosing. Yes.
Exactly. Got it. And does it happen equally in men and women who have underlying sleep disorders, the pulmonary hypertension?
Well,
in your experience.
Okay, so let me explain one thing.
Yeah.
I live at 4,200 feet.
Ah.
Okay. So when I practiced in Pennsylvania for 10 years.
Yeah.
So I didn't see the hypoxia related with sleep that I see in Utah.
Oh, interesting.
And then I have patients that will have cabins up in the mountains.
Mm.
So they'll be at 8,000 feet.
Mm.
So my cohort of patients are vastly different.
Mm.
Like, and I'll have patients, it's typically not the young people, but people will come ski, you know, come out to Utah, they'll go up to Park City and they get sick.
Yeah.
You
know,
you probably have friends who, if you go ski, some of them can't like go to a ski area that's super high.
Right, right, right. That's right. Interesting.
So we have more hypoxia, right? Just as a baseline.
Yeah. Do you get people with a lot of elevated hematocrits and things mm-hmm. like that?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Because I found my hematocrit went up just moving to Las Vegas. We were up in Summerlin. It's like 3,000 feet. Not even that high. But I was swimming a lot, and my hematocrit was like 50 or something. I
so
forget.
So you
what
were blood doping as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm
so
just.
So then when you came down, you made sure you did your races in here.
Exactly. Come back to the bay, come down to sea level. I'm crushing the competition.
Yeah, that's
what you do. With all the amazing sports that I do because, it's kind of interesting. But yeah, so that's fascinating. So, man, anything else you want to leave us with?
You know, I think that what we need to understand is there's not a blame here. Let's just have open conversations and receive, kind of patients where they are.
Mm.
And I do think this kind of slipped as far as everybody understanding the potential damages.
Mm.
And the science has lagged behind what we know about any kind of vaping.
Yeah.
So vape nothing in your lungs. Don't breathe anything in your lungs but clean air.
I like that. I kind of like that.
If you need to do THC, do an edible, there's other options.
Do you hear that, everyone? Dixie Harris says, eat that weed.
No idea. If you need to.
That's all. That makes a lot of sense. And are there any websites or anything, any resources that I can point people to? Or is it just,
So probably the best website. And, we never did show the x-rays.
Oh, no. We show them after the fact. I put them in. Yeah.
Okay. Just making sure.
Yeah.
The CDC has a beautiful picture of E-Valley. It's a beautiful diagram, a cartoon of kind of what it looks like as far as how it was burning the lungs.
Ah, so
there's
CDC.
Really great resources on the CDC for patients, for providers. There's a good picture dictionary about all the different types of electronic devices. So it's really a good resource, and we've worked really hard. I've been one of their clinicians that's helped through the eValley, but there's a lot of people that work super hard on this.
Okay, that's important. So I will include the CDC links to learn more about eValley and vaping-related injury. People can find you on the internets, I'm sure, at Intermountain. If you're in Utah, they can find you as a doctor. You're going to get all these people, I have mild asthma, and I was like, no, I just sat on the show. Take care of very sick people. There's very few of us. So thank you, Dixie
You're
Harris,
welcome.
Dr. Harris, for everything that you've done as what's effectively a citizen scientist, because this was not part of some big university study to identify this. You really are responsible for saving and changing lives.
Well, it's the whole team, our whole ICU, telecritical care team, all our nurses, everybody is working hard on this.
That's awesome. And I want to thank Intermountain Healthcare for letting you off the offer for an afternoon to come hang out with us, because I know there's other people covering and they're like, why did she get to go and I don't get to go?
That's right.
So thanks a million. And ZPAC, listen, guys, if you like this kind of content and stuff, support the show, subscribe on YouTube, Facebook, all the usual jazz. But the main way you can support us is by sharing this content, especially this episode, because we want to get the word out and make sure we don't miss any cases that are arising because we didn't triage it right, we didn't ask the right questions, or our index of suspicion wasn't high. We can learn to talk to our patients. I think my takeaway here is to ask patients, do you breathe anything into your lungs that isn't just plain old air? That's a great way to ask that question. I learned that today. So guys, I love you, and we out. Peace.